Welcome to the Water Resources Podcast. I am Bridget Scanlon. In this podcast, we discuss water challenges with leading experts, including topics on extreme climate events, overexploitation, and potential solutions towards more sustainable management. I'm pleased to welcome Wolfgang Kinzelbach to the podcast. Wolfgang is a professor emeritus of hydromechanics at ETH in Zurich, where he served from 1996 until his retirement in 2014. Wolfgang mentioned to me the other day that he's currently working on reviewing radioactive waste disposal program in Switzerland, so he's still very active. Wolfgang has worked on many different aspects of hydrogeology during his career, including water quantity issues and water quality issues. And today, I think, Wolfgang, we're going to focus on water quantity aspects and a little bit about water quality concerns, talking about the North China Plain and the Tarim Basin in China and various policies. Thank you so much for joining me, Wolfgang.
Well, thank you for your interest in my work.
So, Wolfgang, you spent a lot of time in China. I really appreciate the work you've been doing there. The book that you published titled Groundwater Overexploitation in the North China Plain, A Path to Sustainability, I found it extremely interesting. I like how you describe how the water issues evolved over time. You indicate that up to 2020, groundwater depletion in the North China Plain was one of the global hotspots, with declines of about up to a meter a year in some regions, and that corresponding to about 48 cubic kilometers per year. For context, Texas uses about 20 cubic kilometers of water a year. And of course, that had impacts on subsidence. But the main aspect of the book that I really appreciated is how you work with stakeholders and farmers to develop solutions and work with policymakers. So maybe, Wolfgang, you can describe a little bit about how you got started with the book, and then we can go through the different aspects stepwise.
Okay, this Sino-Swiss groundwater project started in 2012 and it lasted till 2020. It was funded by the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation, by the Chinese Ministry of Water Resources, the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and the Geological Survey of China. And from the beginning, our idea was to try and stop depletion in order to preserve a sufficiently large buffer of groundwater for times of prolonged drought. You know, the resilience of a water management scheme against hydrological variability is determined by its storage capacity. Aquifers are the largest reservoirs, which can bridge years, if not decades, while surface reservoirs are operating on a yearly or at most two-yearly basis. Now, the two things most people will agree about is that climate change, as we already experienced it, is associated with higher temperatures and more frequent extremes. And to adapt to the latter, we need more storage. That's one of the big motivations we had in our project. Now, the location was one particular county in Hebei province, Guangdong. There we worked for these 8 years. Maybe I should just say a few words why groundwater became so important in the North China Plain. In the 1970s, when the first time I was in China, irrigation was largely done with surface water. And I remember that Hebei province was complaining about water logging, salinization. The terrain is so flat that the water applied to the field just does not drain away easily. But with the electrification, the increase in crop production, more water was required, and then people tapped groundwater. Within not much time, the whole problem of water logging was gone because the groundwater table was going down, which was very beneficial, I must say, at that point. People liked the groundwater. It was easily controlled. No big infrastructure was needed. You just switch on the pump and off and on, and you had to pay, of course, for electric energy. But you were still better off for your individual needs and schedule of irrigation. The crop, which really led to the overpumping, that means the continuous drawdown of water levels, was winter wheat. The region has a scheme of double cropping. It's winter wheat from October to May and corn from June to September. The corn is growing in the rainy season, so it needs only one irrigation, and wet years even none. But winter wheat grows in the dry season, and it has to be irrigated 3 to 4 times. in this season, surface water is also rare. Releases by reservoirs do not reach far, and the natural low flow of rivers, if there's any left at all, is basically wastewater. Now, in summer, water is abundant. The question is how to store it. Efforts are ongoing to build smaller storage basins in the plain. Yeah, I would say that was the situation. And now the question is how to stop groundwater tables to go further down. You cannot look at it very naively as one big pot. This North China Plain is an aquifer system. It has shallow aquifer parts and has the deep aquifer, and they're very different. The shallow aquifer is the main source for agricultural irrigation. A lower aquifer, it's not of good quality. It's 3 to 5 gram per liter of dissolved solids. The lower confined aquifer is much better quality. It's drinking water quality. It's used for drinking water, but it's also used for irrigation in places where the phreatic aquifer is too saline for irrigation. So actually, it looks like a paradox. The major drawdown is in the confined aquifer below, although the water drawn from it is much less than drawn from the phreatic aquifer. And it's clear it has to do with the storage coefficient. This confined aquifer can store only little water. So with a little abstraction, you already can make a big drawdown, whereas the phreatic aquifer is not that sensitive to pumping.
I think the trajectory that you described for the North China Plain, Wolfgang, is similar to what the British Geological Survey have described for Northwest India and others in Pakistan, Azim Shah and stuff. They were using surface water a lot in the early and mid-1900s. Then they had salinization and waterlogging issues in Pakistan. Then to counteract that, they had the SCARP program and installing wells. But then they overexploited the groundwater in Pakistan. And now they have recharged Pakistan. So they're trying to recharge the aquifer. So it seemed like we overcorrect. And groundwater is very easy to use, as you say, and you don't have to wait for the canal supplies and you have more control of it individually. Wolfgang, you mentioned double cropping wheat and maize, the wheat being really the issue because it's grown in the dry season in the winter and then requiring a lot of irrigation water. And I was reading and talking to colleagues, you know, it seems like China imports a lot of food now, but you corrected me that it's soybeans and meat and stuff. Still, they're growing a lot of wheat. And maybe you can describe their food policy in the North China Plain and how you see that evolving.
The food policy is still very strict for the grains. So rice, wheat and corn, more than 90%, rice 99%. Is produced in the country and not imported. And this is quite an important policy, which is also one of the reasons why it's difficult to stop the overpumping. I mean, in general, overpumping is a hard problem to solve. Why? Because the crisis comes on the long term, and in the short term, you have gain. So it's short-term gain versus long-term cost. And these problems are always difficult to solve. The administrator says, I will just pass it on to my successor, and the farmers cannot stop. That's their livelihood, this pumping. So you cannot ask them just to stop. And that's difficult to solve. My friend in China said, well, if people would just die from it, it would have been solved a long time ago. But that's not how it works. It's a very gradual thing and nobody dies from it immediately. You have to get into a certain crisis to wake up and to do something. And I think China has reached that point and something has been done. And we see the results already. So everybody says all the aquifers in the world are going down, etc. That's rubbish. So there are fossil aquifers which can be pumped for another 300 years without any problem. And there are problems in aquifers really where it goes down too low and you get to the economic limit of pumping water. But in China, I would say, is the first big scale example which tells you something can be done. The overpumping can be stopped. Of course, small-scale examples, we have quite a few. We have the Eastern La Mancha. We have Orange County, Monterey Bay in California. So it can be done. But on a large scale, we have not seen it, and we now see it in China.
When we chatted the other day, Wolfgang, you were describing the context of the North China Plain and the types of farms, the demographics, the age of the farmers, and things like that. So maybe you can describe that a little bit, these very small farms.
Yeah, it's mainly smallholders. They have about, I'd say, a third of a hectare. I don't know how to calculate that in acres, but you can do the calculation for me, right?
Well, a hectare is 2.5 acres.
Okay, so we have a fraction of the 2.5 acres, maybe a third or a fifth. So that's very little. You cannot get rich on that. What you produce over of this land on the year, it cannot make you rich, never, right? So this is a real problem for farming, the style of farming. And this has to change, and it is in a big process of change. Change from these small farms, which are not viable economically, to something bigger, to bigger units. When you go to these villages, you look at the farms, then you see only old people. The young people notice that they cannot become rich and they go to the city to work. The young, old people are there and they're getting older because of China's overaging problem. Does this have a future? It has not a future already due to the age of the people. So what will happen? I have seen some indications of that. We have also some big farms. And it happens the following way. The farmers are allowed to rent out their land for a certain amount, which is fixed, to other farmers. This is done sometimes on a very informal basis, sometimes on a bigger basis. I know a village where the whole village put the land together to make one big commercial enterprise. And that's also something which is starting to happen. I have seen these family farms where you go for eating, etc., on the weekend. They also take land of others so that they become self-sufficient and they can serve food and people can play in that land. So that's something which works and which made income a viable farming. Now, the farm I would like to describe to you is a farm where they produce seed maize for the whole county. That's also a big farm which is put together like a mosaic by renting land from other farmers. This is the one farm where I saw really a young man working with his father, a lot of machinery. They use drones to do pesticide application. They use sprinkler irrigation. They were the ones who were really interested in our project by asking us, please measure how much we pump. We want to know whether we can save. This is the future. And the future is even looking a bit more, I would say, technological. The modern farmer in Switzerland or in the US, I mean, this is a guy who is an engineer. He's not this image of a guy who stands in the field and digs in the mud, right? He looks at the weather report. He has it in his computer. From the computer, he steers his center pivot irrigation. Maybe he does even better what we call precision agriculture. He only puts the pesticides where he can notice with this drone that the bugs are eating the leaves. There is even sensors which tell you how much nitrate you have in the soil, and then you will only fertilize in the places which are deficient. So this is the future where you don't need this, let's say, farmer which only works according to his experience, but a farmer who is becoming more of an engineer and does it in a more scientific or economic way. This is where the things are going. And there are farms in China which are already of that type, but not in Hebei province so much, but in the northern Heilongjiang, or in Xinjiang, big state farms, they already use this kind of techniques.
It's fascinating. And I grew up in Southwest Ireland and visiting there last fall, some farmers, they were taking photos of some health problems they had with some cattle and looking up an AI to figure out what was wrong with them and everything. I think this image of a farmer that needs to change, and maybe we will get more people into farming. We call it big ag here in the U.S., and I've been to conferences in Nebraska, the Doherty Water for Food Institute. They bring in farmers to talk about, it's a big economic enterprise. And so they have the big tractors and they can be watching videos or listening to books or whatever while they go through the fields and all of this sort of things. Mm.
Yeah, and the automation is also necessary because of the lack of young people, the lack of workers in the future years. It comes at the right time, I would say.
In your book, you describe one of the things that you needed to know to manage the groundwater was how much they were already pumping to do the accounting of the water budget. Exactly. So maybe you can describe how you were able to get the farmers to monitor how much they were pumping.
Yeah, to really understand the water balance in aquifer, you need to measure not only the water tables, but also the extraction, how much water you take out. The measurement of water tables has been done, not in a very dense way. There is a certain number of stations by the Geological Survey in Hebei province, which are even equipped with automatic data transmission, etc. But then this net had to be densified for our purposes in the county. That was done by our colleagues in the Geological Survey. Yeah, that is one side. The other side is, as you say, we want to know how much is pumped and how can you get that number. Now, of course, you can put equipment to put a flow meter into every pump, etc., etc. And this turned out to be difficult. Well, we have done it in other places. We have done it in Gansu province in a place called Losochang, where all the wells were equipped with a smart water meter. Now, what is this? This is a thing which is produced in China in large quantities, and it goes on a well, and you operate it with a swipe card. You get your water allowance on a swipe card, and then you pump, and then each time you pump and you close down the pump, it is subtracted from your total water right. These single smart meters on the wells, they are connected via the internet to a central server, so the server can see whether it's operating or not. It's very critical that this infrastructure is working. If the meter doesn't work and you cannot pump, then the farmers will just kick it away and pump in the usual way, right? They have to repair it immediately. It's not enough just to install that system, but also you have to maintain it over time. And that was done in that particular place in a very good way. It works up to today, 13 years without problems. Why did it work? Number one, it was a private enterprise who put in that system, and their income was depending on the system to work, because with the working system, the water fee comes in, and then from the water fee, they can do the maintenance. Now, why did the water fee work, which is not working in other parts of China? The water fee worked because the farms there are not as small as in North China Plain. They're much bigger, and several families use one well together. And then for this well, there is the smart meter, and they pay, apart from the electricity, a water fee, which is bearable. They can do it. It's not too much for them because they have a higher income from their fields. They can pay a water fee, and they pay it from the first cubic meter on. From the first cubic meter, you have to pay. Now, this is the crux in the North China Plain. Number one, the wells are a factor 10 smaller in pumping rate than in Gansu. That's the first thing. The second thing is these wells are usually so primitive, they are not really equipped to put on the smart meter. They try to put in smart meters. They put in about 2,000 smart meters just the year before we arrived. After 3 years, only 6 of those were still working because the Chinese government is very willing to invest in infrastructure. But it is not willing to invest into the maintenance. The maintenance then they leave to the local people. And if they can't do it, the system breaks down. This is the problem. And why did it break down? Well, because it didn't spawn money for maintenance. And the way it didn't spawn money for maintenance is because they could not charge the farmers money. They did a lot of prescriptions, how to calculate a fee, etc., etc. But the fee was only for water, which goes above the water right. The water right was already a bit too high for sustainability, I must say. And then you go a bit above that, you are still too high for sustainability. But the difference is so small that when you calculate the fees, it was not even worthwhile to go and collect it. That is why up to today, no water fees are required. But what is done is the monitoring. And when we found out all these gadgets, they don't really work, we switched to using energy as a proxy. But if you just use energy, of course, you're not very fair to the farmer who has a deeper water table or a farmer who has less transmissivity or who has an older pump. To get to the water, we connected the amount of kilowatt hours to the amount of cubic meters by doing pumping tests at individual levels. This was done by my postdoc, Liu Wang, who is from the region, who did admirable work in this field, collecting all these data and calibrating the wells by pumping tests. In the end, we were so far that we had at least in every village or in every well group, at least one test pumping to combine to get from electricity to cubic meter. So this is the first time that we really knew how much the people were pumping. That is what you have to know in order to determine how much you have to reduce. You cannot reduce without knowing what is really pumped. My biggest success, I would say, in this whole project was that the province, the whole province of Hebei, liked this approach. They took it up. They even developed a box where you can at the same time measure the flow and the electricity at the well and made this whole test pumping much faster. And this is now the practice done overall. I'm a bit proud of that.
I can imagine that. That's amazing because, I mean, you highlight a big issue. It seems like governments and state agencies, they're quite willing to put up the capital to install different things or do different projects. They're very slow to provide any long-term funding for maintenance or operations. I mean, we saw it with USAID in Africa and even in the US with the infrastructure law. You know, there was all money for installation and purchasing and all this sort of thing, but no funding for operations. Mm. So I think that's a general issue in many regions.
Let me just add one sentence maybe, because what was also happening and which was very positive for the development is that the electricity firms, the utilities, they introduced smart electricity meters. They did it on every well, actually. We know the electricity very well, even in 6-hour intervals. You could even look over the day at these data. China is very advanced in all these electrical gadgets. The well looks like Stone Age, but then you have an electric pump in it. And the moment you have that, you are in space age. That is something I think I have seen a lot in China, these automatic systems, which all work with big data, etc., which is quite beneficial for this scaling up of observation of, let's say, pumpings.
Yeah. Wolfgang, you were recently visiting Shijiazhuang. It's kind of an agricultural research center where you have a lot of colleagues. And it's really interesting on the work they're doing, looking at groundwater use and crop production. With all of the monitoring data that you've been collating then with this program, what was one of the biggest surprises that you had from looking at the monitoring data? Yeah. How much they're pumping?
Okay, let me first say, if people usually have this idea that these farmers waste water or even fertilizer. That's not true. I mean, in North China Plain, if you put enough water or too much water on the field, it usually trickles down and becomes groundwater recharged. There is very little lost. We only talk about this non-utilized or non-beneficial water which evaporates without going through the plant, which is a waste. Very little. Also, they do deficit irrigation naturally. I mean, if you do a full irrigation up to get the maximum yield, if you just reduce by 20%, the yield does not go down 20%. It goes down a little. That is what you call deficit irrigation. And they do this naturally. So we have already farmers who want to save money on the electricity fees and don't exaggerate. So this is what one has to keep in mind. You cannot do much more in saving. Now, the water is already rising in the upper aquifer and it's going down much slower in the lower aquifer. Why? I can tell you there are three components which lead to this rise. Number one is a very bold scheme, that is the south-north water transfer. The south-north water transfer solved this problem mainly in Beijing and around Beijing. Hebei is not taking too much of it, but in Hebei, they replace the drinking water wells in the lower aquifer by water from this canal, from the south-north water transfer. They put this water for treatment into a water firm, water factory, and then this factory supplies the drinking water. So this water is not pumped from groundwater anymore. That is number one. The second component was measures in the villages. And one was to not plant winter wheat. So there was for a certain amount of fields, not too much because of this demand to stay self-sufficient, right? There was a subsidy. You get that much money if you don't plant winter wheat. This was accepted very positively by farmers because they hardly earn anything. Usually they cross-subsidize the winter wheat with the gain from the summer maize. So they switched off this and they took that money instead. Now you also have a problem of how to monitor this. And this we also solved. We solved it by satellite observation. In spring, the only thing which is green is the wheat fields, right? You can see them so easily. And of course, you have a smog and fog sometimes. But then we use the radar satellites to see the scatter from these little leaves. We had very good monitoring, and we even compared then whether it's really the fields which have been subsidized, whether they really have switched off the wheat planting. So this worked, and this is also a component. This is interesting in China. You know, before doing a policy, they make experiments. This is societal experimentation. They say, let these villages do that and those villages do that. In the end, they compare what worked. Now, how do you make a farmer save water without letting him pay for the water? They are so poor, you cannot take money out of a naked man's pocket, right? What they did is they gave the farmers in the beginning of the irrigation season a certain amount of money. From that money, the farmer had to pay the water with a normal water fee. And what was left over was the farmers. So he had an incentive to irrigate less, right? This was an interesting way of introducing a fee without having a financial load on the farmer. Too many of these things were tried out. This worked in some villages, it didn't work in others. So there's also a mixed reaction, but I think it's a very good idea to do this kind of testing, what will work with the farmers in the region. I talked about the first component, the water transfer. The second component is these many measures, which also included this storage basins, yeah? That you have a storage basin, which is filled in the rainy season, and then it gradually trickles down. It's a kind of managed aquifer recharge. We measure these ponds, and you find out half of the water is evaporated, but half is going into the aquifer. And also, they can be pumped directly by the adjacent fields, like a little reservoir. This was done more and more. I would say it has effects in two ways, right? You have water, but on the other hand, it takes land area. And this land area is not planted, so it's also not irrigated, right? So irrigated land has been lost to infrastructure that also reduces the area on which you can plant the winter wheat, of course, right? So these things all helped in the direction that things are going up. And the last thing, I think the Chinese weather god, he saw that they're doing so well in all their efforts that he said, now I will give you a present. And he put on a few big rains in the last year. So I would say one third is the contribution of these three things to this rising of groundwater tables in the shallow aquifer and a further reduction of pumping in the lower aquifer. It's one thing though, unintended consequences. You know, there are houses now who have been built in the time of very low water tables. Another water table comes up and then the cellar is in the water. These things also happen. Huh? I have seen this also in Germany, by the way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I really like that approach where they give the farmers the money at the beginning and then that encourages them to save water. Any money that's left over, then they have it. So that's really cool. And I think another thing you mentioned the other day, you talk about double cropping wheat and maize, one policy to produce enough wheat for the country, but then another policy to reduce wheat production to save groundwater.
This policy of subsidies is a bit contradictory. No? On one hand, you introduce a subsidy not to plant winter wheat. On the other hand, you give a subsidy to plant wheat because otherwise you don't have enough wheat. And then there is a subsidy on electricity. I told them, why do you do all this measuring? Just make the electricity more expensive, then people will use less water. But that was taboo because I tell you why. The electricity firm was against it. They say, we want to sell electricity. This is when you have different independent kingdoms within the same country who are opposing each other. And that is when something has to be said from the very top.
And I really like how you describe, you know, how you're able to monitor the winter wheat production. So if they say they're not going to grow it, you can see it with the satellites then if they do or they don't. So that's fascinating. But another aspect that you mentioned, Wolfgang, was the greenhouses. I noticed when I took the train from Wuhan to Beijing one time, I mean, I couldn't believe all of the greenhouses on the way. And it's not double cropping. It's, I don't know how many times they harvest those vegetables and stuff.
You're right. This is when you asked about surprises I had. This was one of the surprises. I was not surprised at the general pumping rate. That was in the order of magnitude of what you estimate just by plant use and the usual formulae. But the greenhouses, yeah, that's a lot. The greenhouse is conserving water because it reduces the evaporation. Of course, you cannot close the greenhouse. You have to let something out because you have to let CO2 in. Sometimes the farmers have greenhouses where in winter they warm it. The off-gas with the CO2 is let into the greenhouse as a fertilizer, right? Then you would not have to open it to exchange water. Then you can conserve the water. This is nice on one hand. But on the other hand, you can grow at any time of the year practically. And that means, as you said, it's not only double cropping, it's triple or quadruple cropping. Of course, you let the soil rest in between. And that is also in the rainy season when you open the whole thing and you let the direct rain from above come down to be stored in the soil, right?
The greenhouses we have there, they're not hugely sophisticated, but possibly you said they could accommodate, they could use drip irrigation, plastic mulching and other things.
There are very primitive ones, which are made temporarily from the mud in the field, and then you put this plastic sheet over it. But there are very sophisticated ones too, where all the opening of the aeration, etc., is done automatically. And there's experiments on, this is a special thing in China, you know. And you have it, of course, in the most developing countries, that you have the Stone Age next to Space Age, right? So you have all the spectrum of things, one beside the other. And they are very sophisticated greenhouses. Also hydroponics. I visited such hydroponic farms just recently, and they are very good, but they are still twice as expensive as the market outside. The cost is still the limiting thing for that. Yeah, I think in China in general, one must say the food is too cheap. It is too cheap, but it must be cheap. Otherwise, the people in the city will make a revolution. And the Chinese government is most afraid of that. The farmers have to suffer because they want quiet people in the city, right?
You mentioned in the US, we have these community-supported agriculture. They talk about farm-to-table and subscription or share the farm's harvest. And I forget, I won't try to pronounce the word that you use to describe that in China. So your colleagues, your friends in Beijing do that to make sure that maybe no pesticides are used in the food or different things for food security.
Yes.
So maybe you can describe that a little bit.
Yeah, I would say it's an avant-garde. Intellectual people who are mainly worried that their children are getting these pesticides and it's bad for their health. And so I know some families who are together and they buy from a farmer in the outskirts of Beijing. And he guarantees that he does not use pesticides and does this organic farming. And then they get the fresh produce inside the city. I think we have that in Switzerland too. Maybe there it's not so much the pesticide problem, but we want to have locally produced food, which is not transported all over Europe, causing a lot of emissions by this transport, right? I think it's a nice thing, but of course, you always have to look at the quantity to say whether something is good or helping or not. This is the avant-garde. It's still a marginal thing in the complete market. But you need the avant-garde to push things in a certain direction. And this is what I sometimes lack in China, that the avant-garde is not allowed to speak out. They are too cautious, right? You need these early sensors which look where the tendencies are and which direction things are going. They could inform you a lot about where to go, right? For some things, it works.
Mm-hmm. It's a pilot testing proof of concept. And so when I was at a conference in Lubbock last year, there were farmers there talking about growing vegetables and they didn't have enough water to support a large farm growing wheat or maize or corn, you know, whatever. So they're growing small plots of vegetables, selling them in the local market. And even the Huffington Foundation, we have funding from them. They are doing this in Colorado. So I agree, it's small and it's a bit like managed aquifer recharge. These are not huge things there, but maybe they help. And they're not probably scalable to a large scale. Wolfgang, you gave a nice description of the aquifer system in the North China Plain, the shallow system, a confining unit, and a deeper confined system. Now the water levels are rising in the shallow aquifer. Are there any concerns about water quality issues?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I would say in 10 years, nobody is going to talk about this water level decline anymore. The thing is over. It's being solved. Huh? But what happens when you have the lower aquifer has larger depression in piezometry than the upper aquifer? So the difference in head between the two aquifers has become large. because the lower went down faster than the upper. So the distance is large. Now, the lower is stagnant or still going down a little, and the upper one is going up. So the difference becomes even larger. And it's this difference which drives water, it's little, but over the area, it's still a lot, drives water from the upper to the lower aquifer. Now, the lower aquifer is drinking water. The upper aquifer is not very good water, not for drinking, it's just barely for agriculture. Then these clay layers in between, these confining layers, they have even higher salinity. This would be pushed down into the lower aquifer. So there is this danger that this wonderful research, which should be really reserved for strategic reasons as a drinking water resource, that this may over time be impaired in its quality. So this
right.
is definitely yeah. something one should watch out for in the future. That is the next step after this, solving the quantity problem. Yep.
You mentioned in the shallow aquifer, you know, the soil concentrations about 3 to 5 grams per liter. We usually talk about milligram per liter. So that's 3,000 to 5,000 milligrams per liter. Yeah.
Yes.
And so concerned then to bring that down into the deeper aquifer. When you have the south to north diversion, then it's really the municipalities and people in towns and stuff that can afford that water. But then by getting them off of the groundwater, then that helps the situation.
Yeah, you see, that is why they use this water to replace drinking water. Because for drinking water, you can pay more than for irrigation water. But that also limits the scope of how much you can take from the north-south water transfer. In the recent years, they had too much. So what did they do? They took this water and put it in old riverbeds. You know, you have these riverbeds which are dry because all the water has been stored in reservoirs in the mountains, in the close by mountains, small reservoirs. The riverbed is the place where you have hydraulic conductivities which allow the water to go down. Usually you have fields which on top have a very rich clayey soil. It's not so easy for water to go down. It still goes down. Of course, you have an aerial recharge in that quite sizable, right? But there, it would be preferentially going down. And that is why they put it in these riverbeds. And the result was they saw the groundwater tables coming up close to the river. So for the farms close to the river, this helps. They can get their groundwater now directly from that close to the river. But then you are not everywhere close to that river. It doesn't work for the whole area. But it's a contribution. It's kind of this problem where you don't have what the Chinese called one knife to cut everything, right? It's something where you have to make a mosaic of many different things to solve the problem as a whole.
I think sometimes we use the expression, one size fits nobody.
Yeah. Chinese say, it out here, it means one knife, to cut everything with one knife.
Right. For resilience, then having a portfolio of things that you can use. And you mentioned earlier, and I think it was good, you know, some people say, well, if all irrigation was drip irrigation, but in California now and other places, they're using, they call it flood manage out for recharge or ag manage out. So they flood the fields in the winter when they have the water and then to recharge.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah.
I mean, this happened in China in these big rains inadvertently. And that helped with groundwater recharge. The Japanese are doing this also a lot. Yeah? It's a good practice. And it's not yet that popular in China, only when they're forced to by a really heavy rain, right? So, yeah, right. I agree.
One of the other areas that you've done quite a bit of work is in the Tarim Basin in the western part of China.
Around Lake Bostan, which is the biggest lake in Xinjiang. In that place, the problem was salinization. You know, have very high evaporation, you have not much natural rain, very little rain, and then you have to irrigate 100% everything. And then the irrigation was from reservoirs in the mountains. And if you irrigate in a desert area, what happens is the water table comes up. It comes within this 1 or 2 meters where the capillary rise will then bring the water up. And then you get these potash and salt crusts on the fields. And then they become sterile after a while. So that is what happened there. They developed a lot of things to leak out the salts by having canals with this different water level. You feed water in one and you take water out of the other one to flush through the soil and all these things. Then it was proposed, I was among those people who were in favor, that we use groundwater. You know, there is this amount of water which comes up and is called phreatic evaporation directly from groundwater. This is a resource which you can use if you push the groundwater table down. We said, okay, you have to push the groundwater table down. Wells were installed and people loved it. They loved it. Why? Because you can switch on and off. You can do drip irrigation. If you do drip irrigation with the water from the mountain, it has a lot of sediment. You have to get rid of the sediment in some turbine thing before you can put it in your drippers. Otherwise, they clog all the time. The groundwater was fantastic. You want to irrigate now with surface water. You have to call the dispatcher at the reservoir in the mountains. Then the water comes in big quantities. You don't know what to do with it. You cannot do this more precise irrigation. So that is why they loved it and it spread over the whole place. Then, of course, they overdid it. They not only use this part of the resource, which is phreatic evaporation, they use more. The problem is that people say the North China Plain now is practically solved, but the big problems are now there in Xinjiang, the overpumping. Yeah, what can one do? We had a suggestion. You know, in earlier times, there was a big movement to insulate, to make the canals watertight, that water does not infiltrate before coming to the field. I suggested now, together with my friend, just tear that out with the water from the mountains, do groundwater recharge so that people have something to pump. It's just the opposite of what one has done before. We will see. They have to get into a real crisis so that they will solve things. I think groundwater is this problem where you have to get in a crisis, then you solve it. It's not the problem where people fall down and die. It's a problem where in the end you run into a wall and then you solve it. It will also be solved there, but it takes still some time to make it hurt enough, right?
Right. And you know what you just described, I mean, same thing in Pakistan. They were using surface water and then the salinity problems and the waterlogging, and then they went to groundwater, but then they went too far.
Exactly. That's what happened in Xinjiang too.
The other thing that you described, lining the canals, you know, and not understanding that that water recharges the aquifer. Mm-hmm. I think some examples in Murray-Darling Basin, precision agriculture, you know, lining canals and everything, it didn't really take into account that they were losing that recharge, you know.
And then the farmers like the water table, yeah.
Some differences between North China Plain and Tarim Basin. I mean, you described very small farms, less than an acre in the North China Plain.
Yeah.
In the Tarim Basin, that they're much bigger farms.
Different, but these are big farms. You have the farms of the state. And then you have these more privately owned farms that they're also larger. There is the problem. To solve the problem in North China Plain is relatively easier. Why? Everything which is under the plow is already under the plow. And eventually it's even reduced by infrastructural areas which are cut away. Now in Xinjiang, you have infinite area. It's an area which is perfectly utilizable for agriculture. The only thing it really lacks is water. If you irrigate, you can grow. And that is what is happening. In year 2000, the Chinese government said it's illegal to turn wasteland into irrigated fields. And you look at the satellite maps, 2000, 2001, 2005, the green patches are growing and growing. So this is the real problem of water and sustainability in Xinjiang. It has taken over producing some things which formerly maybe were produced in North China Plain. They produce more wheat now. They produce the cotton, they produce maize, and they produce wheat. These are the biggest quantities. And of course, tomatoes and these hot peppers, you know. I was standing in these huge fields of hot peppers, and I asked the farmer, I said, who can eat that hot food? And I said, no, 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 this is not for food. This is industrial hot pepper, which is used for the red color of the lipsticks. The Koreans buy it. I said, oh, that brand is hopefully called Hot Kisses.
How do you see the Tarim Basin? You know, you've got the mountains, Tian Shan and Kunlun Mountains around, and that has been supplying water from glacier melt and the surface water.
There's this whole question of climate change. What if the glaciers are not there? All the rivers, except for small streams, which come from the mountains, are dammed in the mountains. And the dam in the mountain makes sense because it has a large depth, small areas. The evaporative losses are relatively small. But also we have in Xinjiang some areas, some reservoirs in the plain. These will lose 2 meters. That's the potential evaporation. If they are 5 meters deep, you already lose almost a half just by evaporation. That is a bad thing. Now, these mountain streams being dammed has the advantage that it doesn't matter whether it's rain, which is coming down in the mountain, or snow melt, or glacier melt, it's all captured in the dam. Now, if the glaciers are no longer there, the snow is still coming. This is probably increasing. So there is some good prospect of climate change for Xinjiang in the sense that if the Indian Ocean is warmer, it evaporates more and more will get across the Himalayas, the Kunlun Mountains, into Xinjiang and to the Tian Shan where it drains down. So it could balance out. Of course, higher temperatures means also more evaporation. So we will see how this ends. It will put a limit to the amount of area. This constant extending of irrigated perimeters is not feasible. It's not sustainable. It has to stop or even be reduced. And maybe that will be the agent which makes it stop.
It's really cool, Wolfgang. We can see so much from satellites these days. And, you know, you see winter wheat or you can see the irrigation expansion. When I was preparing for this, looking at NASA images of all of the expansion of the greenhouses, you know, so they were green in late 80s, 90s, and then now they're just all plastic. So it's really fascinating. And I think China accounts for maybe 60% of global greenhouse production. So anyway, I really appreciate that you spend so much time in China. You work with the farmers. You get the picture, your boots on the ground. It's amazing being able to monitor all of this puppet now and how you guys develop. That is absolutely fantastic. So people have an idea. We're always grappling with how to get data, monitor and stuff like that. Seems like you have managed to do that and scale it up in the North China Plain. Our guest today is Wolfgang Kinzenbach, and we will also provide the script and highlights and linkages to papers and to his book and all of these other things on the website. And he's Professor Emeritus at ETH in Zurich. So thank you so much, Wolfgang, for talking with me today.
I thank you for a lively conversation. Thanks a lot.